Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is DeliverMed Holdings against Schultenbrand. Mr. Cox.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Courtney Cox. I appear today on behalf of the appellants. This case presents actually two cases for the court today. With the court's permission, I'd like to first address the case of Swift versus Schultenbrand, the 3774 case. This is a case arising out of an oral partnership. The district court found that there were three partners to that partnership, each having a different percentage of ownership. And there are actually two issues that are presented here today that they're integral, important issues to this partnership. And we believe the findings of the trial court were clearly erroneous on both points. First, the point is that the court found that one of the partners, Mark Swift, dissociated himself from the partnership. In other words, the court found that he gave notice of his express will to withdraw from the partnership, and this is found in Illinois Partnership Law at 805 ILCS 206. The court made a second finding we think is equally clearly erroneous, and that is that not only did Swift dissociate himself from the partnership, but he wrongfully dissociated himself from the partnership. And he found that based on a very specific reason. The reason is he said he left the partnership before the ultimate purpose was realized. The court found that the ultimate purpose of that was the sale of the book of customers. This partnership actually was a mail order pharmacy business, and they would build up a book of customers by accumulating customers, and the court found that the idea was to sell that book of customers and that would be the end of the partnership. Now, both of these determinations were clearly erroneous, but let me first address the dissociation issue. In order to understand this, we have to begin with this premise that all three partners, Swift, Schultenbrand, and Siddle, all testified at trial that they believed Swift was still a partner at the time of trial. In other words, that he had not dissociated himself. Now, we look at the defendant's response to that, and we see that there was a point later in the trial, after Mike Schultenbrand had testified that he believed Swift to still be a partner at the time of the trial, where his attorney tries to rehabilitate him. And we see it's set forth in our reply brief verbatim. I won't take the time now to read it for you, but basically what happens is he says, I assumed it had terminated back in September. What we see is that in addition to them admitting Swift was still a partner and had not dissociated himself, we see that Swift is still shown on the financial records as a partner long after this alleged dissociation. And finally, the court itself, in making a finding at document 287, page 21 and number 72, that in early 2010, after the time the court found he had dissociated, the court found that Schultenbrand had spent so much money and taken so much money out of the business, there were no profits to be divided among the partners. And that language is very important because it's a recognition that there were three partners at that time. So how did the court determine or make this finding of dissociation? What did he base it on? He based it on two things. The first thing he based it on was a letter from Swift's attorney. Swift's attorney, on September the 1st, 2009, wrote a letter to Mike Schultenbrand. And in the letter, he says, This letter is in response to your request to dissolve the partnership. And in, under questioning by defendant's attorney, Mike Schultenbrand said that he believed the attorney thought that Charlton Brand had requested a dissolution. And in the letter, he indicates that Swift is amenable to a dissolution. He doesn't say that Swift wants out of the partnership, but he's amenable to the idea of a dissolution. The other thing the court relied upon in finding this dissociation was certain actions taken by Swift after he was excluded from the partnership. In other words, from September 1, 2009 on, he was excluded from the partnership, and by excluded, I mean he was cut out of any information about the partnership, and he was cut out of any distributions from the partnership. In other words, he was just
those were pretty extraordinary actions that he took, telling the bank that there would be a bankruptcy, trying to divert customers, and so on, right?
They were extraordinary.
Do you agree that those actions would be sufficient to have allowed a judge to have found under the statute that the partner engaged in wrongful conduct that adversely and materially affected the partnership business?
No, sir, I don't. And I'll tell you why. Because these three things, and I'll explain each one of them, are inconsistent with disassociation, but they are consistent with a person who has been excluded, cut out of the partnership, and is trying to protect his interest. The first is the UCC statement, which was filed afterwards. And, of course, you and I know that the UCC statement under these circumstances would have no effect. In other words, back in the beginning of August, when Mark Swift was very ill, he was concerned about not receiving his dividends and dying. And so he told Mike Schellenbrand, to protect my family, I'm going to file a UCC, which he did, and it had no effect.
We're dealing with district court findings
that
have a very different take on Mr. Swift's intentions, right?
I understand, but when we look at the facts that were presented that are backing up those findings, it's our position that the evidence does not support a finding that his intention was to damage the partnership, but rather to protect
his telling interest. The bank that the company was about to file for bankruptcy?
He did. In fact, that is a true statement. He didn't say that they had filed it. He said he initiated
bankruptcy.
Oh, come
on. I mean, the district judge didn't have to accept that kind of hedging, did it?
Well, actually, there's a document, a letter from an attorney that was introduced into evidence, and I believe it's included in the appendix, showing that's exactly what they were doing.
Mr. Cox, are you telling us that for a partner to go to his partnership's bank and tell it the partnership is preparing to file for bankruptcy cannot reasonably be found to be harmful to the partnership when no such bankruptcy was needed or ever filed?
We know this, first of all.
Would you answer that question?
Yes, I would. I believe that it was not harmful, and it caused no harm at all. In fact, the banker testified it didn't change anything. I didn't even regard it. And so there is no evidence that it caused any harm at all in the record. In fact, the banker, Kip Adkins was his name, he said,
this sounds like an argument that the activity failed, which is different from an argument that no reasonable person could think that it was adverse to the partnership.
Well, if a person is...
To put it differently, I'm asking the same question to Judge Hamilton in a different way.
He fired
your argument today sounds like a closing argument in a jury trial. It doesn't sound like a reason why the district judge's findings are clearly erroneous.
Well, what I'm saying to you is that there is no evidence to support a finding that there was any harm caused to the partnership.
No, that's a different point.
All right.
There was plenty of evidence that Swift had behaved in a way that was adverse to the partnership. You say, well, he failed. But why should his failure, if in your view it is a failure, make it clearly erroneous for the judge to find that these actions imply that Swift thought that he was out?
Swift did think he was out, Your Honor. He did think that. He thought he had been cut off from this partnership. These actions are not actions that support a finding of dissociation that he wanted to be out. Rather, they support a finding that he was excluded from the partnership.
Under your theory of Illinois partnership law, if a partner is doing his very best to devastate the business of the partnership, but is unsuccessful in that effort, he must be allowed to remain in the partnership?
There is no indication that he was trying to damage
the partnership. That is a fair finding and certainly a fair inference from those actions, and the district court drew those inferences. Are you saying that Illinois partnership law does not allow removal, at least by a judicial order, under such circumstances?
Under the circumstances of this case, no, because they are not consistent with dissociating yourself.
You're asking us to reject those. Let me ask, if we were to agree with you that Mr. Swift is still a partner, what would the consequences of such a holding be?
One of the consequences is that he would be entitled to his share of the partnership, and that he would be entitled to his share of the profits of that partnership as they were earned after the time he was excluded.
We've got district court findings that there were no profits. But tell me about, at least up through the time of trial, but tell me about consequences if he's still somehow deemed a partner.
If he's still deemed a partner, then he, if there are profits, he would be entitled to them.
In the
future. He would be entitled to speak to the running of the business, make decisions with
respect. Well, he's a minority partner, so.
Right. He would have some say in it.
Was the issue of whether, if the business were sold tomorrow, do you have a claim, a theory, for which he would be entitled to 35.9% of the value? And if so, what is it?
First, both of his partners testified that in the event that happened, he would be entitled to that. So the partners have all agreed on that. In addition, if the business is sold, he is still entitled to, if he was dissociated, at least the value as of the date of the dissociation.
And what was that, given the district court's findings about damages in this case?
It would be whatever the value is based upon the sale of it. In other words, the value would be determined by the sale amount. In the situation, if we look at the rest of the evidence that backs up our position that there was no dissociation, we see that what was happening in the month before Mark was expelled from the partnership was that a strong indication a number of times from Sheldon Brand, "I want you out." And all that time, Mark Swift was not doing anything to damage the partnership. In fact, the evidence shows that during that month before he was expelled, he was out getting new business for the partnership. And every time Charlton Bram would say to him, "Look, I want you out, basically. I'm finished with you." He would say, "No, wait a minute. Come on, let's work through this. Let's work through it. I've got new business." There were no actions taken before he was expelled on September 1, 2009 by Swift to damage it in any way. Anything that was found to have been an action against the partnership was taken after he was expelled to protect his interest.
And these arguments are the very same arguments you made to the district court, right?
They are.
The district court rejected them. And you've given us no reason to disagree with the district court's finding. Well, I mean, the facts are the facts. The district court had a totally different take on it. The facts that the district court lined up support the finding. So all of us have the fundamental problem with you can't tell us what the error is in the findings of the district court because these facts, the district court looked at them differently. And there's a rational basis, a reasoned basis for the district court's findings.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. And here's where I disagree. It is our position that there was no evidence to show a clear intention of Mark Swift to dissociate himself, to withdraw from the partnership, that when you look at the clear evidence that was presented, the opposite is true. He wanted to stay in the partnership and continue to work as a partner and was doing so up to the very moment when he was expelled and put out of the partnership. And then we add to it the finding of the wrongful dissociation, which is a separate finding. And in a finding of wrongful dissociation, which carries with it more draconian results, which is that you cannot participate at all in the partnership from that point. Here's what the trial court based it on. He based it on this idea that there was a particular purpose for this partnership, and that is to sell the business and end the partnership. The testimony of the defendant, Mike Sheltenbrand, is clearly contrary to that. He said very clearly in his testimony the purpose was to build up the book of business, then to sell the customers and continue on with the partnership, not end it. So that finding of wrongful dissociation is just clearly contrary not to what my client had to say, but to what the defendant testified to. There is no basis. It's just clear error to find it that was the purpose of it.
Mr. Cox, did Mr. Swift ask the district court to award him the value of his share of the partnership, either as of September 1, 2009, or any other time?
He did.
All right. And the district court said?
The district court said, you have dissociated yourself. You expressed your will to leave, and you wrongfully dissociated. You're not entitled to that.
So you're not entitled to anything?
That's correct.
Well, the district judge did award him $50,000, right?
That was for a separate matter for unpaid bonus, not for the partnership interest.
But then the district judge also wound up finding, in essence, that none of the damages evidence added up to a number that he could have used. Let me put it the question this way. What damages evidence did you present that you think the district judge was required to believe and accept?
The judge was required to accept the financial records prepared by Mike Sheltenbrand's brother and father, which they testify were true and accurate, coming from the defendants. And using those records, we were able to calculate the amount that was owed to Mark Swift using their records.
Now, look, the damages information was hotly contested. There were different sets of accounts, very confusing. Point us to the specific calculation that you think is just absolutely unimpeachable. District judge had to accept it.
I can point you to our closing argument where we do the financial analysis using the documents prepared by the Sheltenbrands, and we lay out the complete analysis there.
And was there any rebuttal to that, any critique of that by the defense?
The critique of the defense was you can't trust these financial records. They're
right.
Not accurate.
Yeah.
That was contrary to the testimony of the accountant and his brother.
So Mr. Wenzel had his report that said this company's been losing money, right? Why couldn't the district judge believe that?
The records that were provided, created by the defendants, show the opposite. And we didn't create the records. They did. And when you look at those records, which were said to be accurate, we get an accurate computation, which is basically an admission by them that these are the numbers. And using those numbers, we were able to calculate that. I see that I've...
Thank you, Mr. Cox.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Stein.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, my name is Kevin Stein. I represent the Appalese, Medicaid Pharmacy, Inc., Michael Schaltenbrand, and Joey Siddle. As the court notes, the appellants have a very heavy burden to carry on this appeal. It's a standard of review of clearly erroneous. It's a heavy burden to meet. In this case, the burden is even tougher because the appeal primarily involves questions of fact rather than law. And finally, when the findings of the district court are based upon determinations regarding credibility of witnesses, Rule 52 demands even more deference to the trial court. After considering almost 3 weeks of testimony and hundreds of exhibits, Judge Gilbert made a determination that credibility was the key factor in reaching his decision. Judge Gilbert stated that Swift's testimony frequently contradicted more credible evidence and even his own testimony.
It is not necessary to tell us what is in the judge's opinion. We've all read it.
First of all, I want to talk about the damages issue because I think that will probably dispose of the case in and of itself. People who want damages have to prove them. Swift's required to prove his damages here, and he hasn't done that to a reasonable degree of certainty. Once there's no damage, liability is merely academic, and we don't even need to get to that issue. Judge Gilbert correctly determined that both Swift and Schaltenbrand were overpaid. He based that on Michael Wenzel's.
He basically determined that they were both thieves.
Well,
Swift was the bigger thief, or at least the bigger liar.
I don't think he called Schaltenbrand a liar. I think he said he was negligently uninformed.
He said Swift was completely incredible, and Schaltenbrand was only partly incredible, which is, lack of credibility is a statement that the witness is trying to deceive the court.
But in this case, Your Honors, we had Mr. Swift received $1.6 million in distributions and $1 million in payments to his company, DeliverMed, at a time when the evidence clearly showed that the partnership lost money. And you might wonder how they did that. They did that because there was a $3 million line of credit and an $800,000 supplier purchase terms negotiated by Swift for the partnership that financed these draws. And Michael Schaltenbrand personally guaranteed all of these obligations. So that's how we get the overpayments for a company that's not making any money. As far as the calculation of damages for 2005 to 2007, Swift relies solely on Plaintiff's Exhibit 8. That document is not reliable evidence and proves nothing. The testimony of the accountants who prepared that document stated that it was merely a work paper to keep track of direct expenses and was not treated like a financial statement. It wasn't distributed to the partners. And it clearly did not contain all of the expenses in this type of business. For instance, there was no computer expense, delivery expense, employee benefits, all kinds of expenses shown on the traditional financial statements that weren't shown on this work paper. And that's the sole basis for the defendant's calculation of plaintiff's calculation for damages from 2005 to 2007. From 2008 forward, the calculation of damages by the plaintiff involves a pro rata calculation. They don't even attempt to determine what the profitability was or to even see if there was any profitability. They simply said, if Schaltenbrand gets money, Swift gets money. And that's not the measure of damages. The measure of damages is percentage of profits, and they simply didn't prove that here.
Mr. Stein, let me ask you about on damages. I believe you all had an accountant prepare a report to Ms. Matheny. Is that right? Who prepared a report for purposes of litigation that said that Mr. Swift's share of the partnership should be valued as of September 2009 at $500,000.
That report, we had that prepared for litigation. We never introduced it in evidence because we didn't believe the plaintiffs had met their burden.
Is it in our record? I mean, I've seen it. I'm trying to figure out how it got there.
It might be on a disclosure of an expert witness, but it was never. She was never testified. It was never made part of the record at trial. And the reason I didn't bring that in is because I didn't think the plaintiffs had met their burden on the valuation with their expert.
Okay. Could I ask you a little bit about the dissociation question?
Yes.
On the express will, I'm struggling with how the exchange between Mr. Schaltenbrand and Mr. Swift's lawyer, we want to dissolve, I'm amenable to that, negotiations then collapsed. I don't understand how that can be an express will.
I think that was the culmination of the actions of Mr. Swift that showed his express will. The testimony at trial showed that beginning in about May of 2009, Mr. Swift stopped coming to the partnership, that he told Joe Siddle he wanted to get out of the partnership, that he told his wife, Ann Sikon, that he wanted out of the partnership, and that he actually began doing things inconsistent with being a partner. He actually started selling product to the partnership's primary customer, a union up here in Chicago. He started selling product directly to that union out of the house and receiving payments at his house in Chicago, unbeknownst to the other partners and without reporting it to the other partners. I think that culminated in the letter that you're referring to.
Right, but ordinarily one would expect a deal, right?
Would expect what?
A deal.
Yes.
An agreement to terms.
Yes.
As opposed to leaving Schaltenbrand testifying at trial that Swift is still part of the partnership and would be entitled to a share if we sold today.
I think if you look at that, are there statements made by Schaltenbrand to that effect in the record? Yes. And they're pointed out in the brief. But if you look at the entire transcript and especially the context of those statements, you have Michael Schaltenbrand stating, no, he's not a partner. As of September 1st, he's not a partner. And then finally, because of good cross-examination techniques, they maybe get him to say, okay, he was a partner. But
yeah.
If you look at the
fired as an employee,
yes.
But not removed as a partner. I mean, certainly the partnership never did anything formal. And if I understand this correctly, if you think you've got a partner misbehaving and you want to kick him out, you've got to get a judge to do that, right?
If he didn't dissociate, you're right.
Okay.
But the trial court here found he dissociated, and I think there's ample evidence to support that.
Now, there's adequate evidence to indicate he was interested in doing that and that he was misbehaving. I'm not sure the door got closed.
Well, no, I guess I understand your point, Judge, but by the same token, Mark Swift, if he thought he was wrongfully excluded, also had rights under the Online Partnership Act. He could have brought a lawsuit for dissolution or for some sort of breach or have a receiver appointed. He didn't do that. Instead, he decided to redirect telephone numbers for the customers, threaten bankruptcy, and do other bad acts. One other point I would make, another basis for the dissolution, wrongful dissolution in this case, would be the fact that this partnership was formed in July of 2005. Mark Swift filed bankruptcy in October of 2005, and under the Partnership Act, that itself is a wrongful dissolution.
Sir, when was that? When
October of 2005, that Mark Swift filed personal bankruptcy.
Well, but everybody kept going after that, right?
They did.
So it's a little hard to treat that as a dissociation. But that 3 years, 4 years before what you say is the dissociation, right?
Well, as a matter of law, I think it would be dissociation. Whether the partners somehow waived that, I don't know.
And then you've got, but they just keep going.
Right.
I mean, look, this was all very informal, which is why you guys have made so much money off of this dispute, right? I think I saw that was what Mr. Siddle said had happened to all the company's profits, right? It's all been paid to the bankers and the lawyers. People take a foolish course, and that's what happens. Let me ask you, if Mr. Schaltenbrand and Mr. Siddle agree to sell the business tomorrow, what happens to the proceeds, as you understand it?
I believe it's their money, because I think Mr. Swift may have had a claim in September of 2009 upon dissociation. Through his lawyer, he demanded payment for a little over $2 million. That wasn't paid, and I think under the Illinois Partnership Act, you have 1 year to file an action for payment. If you don't do that, the statute of limitations is run, so I don't think he has a claim. If he had a claim, I think the damages, first of all, I think he's litigated the damages issue and he didn't prove it, but if for some reason he hasn't done that, then I think he may be entitled to his portion, less any money that he was already overpaid. But I think, number one, the statute's run on that, and number two, he's already litigated and lost. He can't litigate it again. There are no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.